This is Mary Lewis at A Tiny Homestead, the podcast comprised entirely of conversations with homesteaders, cottage food producers, and crafters. Today I'm talking with Jim Melvin about native plants to North Carolina and a seed repository and his book. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well.
Good. So I'm going to preface this whole thing by saying that Jim is a talented writer and he's a friend of mine. And I actually helped him put out an ebook many years ago. And I think it was called Dream House, I think.
That's correct.
And I don't think it's available anymore, but it was for a while. And Jim and his wife live in South Carolina. And so, Jim, tell me about what you're doing and what is it that you're into right now?
Yeah. Well, there's two things we can talk about. You had approached me to talk about my writing as a craft. But just to start out, I live in an area called the East Ottowe Valley, which is in the upstate of South Carolina on the border of North Carolina in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And we built a new home, sort of our dream home, on 15 wooded acres. And we cleared about an acre for the house and have since contracted with these landscapers who are experts in native plants. We're very big and on protecting and enhancing the environment. One of the best ways you can do that as a homeowner is to plant native plants as opposed to plants from all around the world. And eventually the plants that we're going to have in our yard are going to be very rare, difficult to find. And so we're going to become the seed repository that hopefully will lead to these plants being planted in a lot of other people's yards and a lot of other places that will be beneficial to the environment.
That is amazing. See, I knew there was a reason I wanted to talk to you. I knew it. So what is specifically native to where you are?
There's a variety of grasses, flowers, trees, bushes. I'm not exactly an expert in terms of naming them all. My wife is more the expert. And of course, these two people that we hired are the experts. But the thing about native plants, number one, they're native for a reason. They grow in a specific area for a reason, and they tend to be far more beneficial than plants that are not native plants. For instance, they attract beneficial insects like caterpillars, and they attract birds, and they attract wildlife, and they consume carbon, and they do just everything that is good for the environment. And so when you plant a yard filled with native plants, if every single person who owned even a small yard did that, it would have a huge effect on the environment, on climate change, and just overall it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, we, I'm still in Minnesota. I will be in Minnesota till I die, I think. And we tried to put in some native plants a couple summers ago, and we've had two summers of pretty bad drought here. Mm. And we got some native coneflower, which is echinacea, and that's really good for upper respiratory stuff. Mm-hmm. And they didn't make it. And we put in some other things and they didn't make it because it's just the roots just could not get established.
Right.
So crossing my fingers that this summer will be a reasonable summer and that we won't be in a drought again so that I can try again on the native plants, because we spent like $200 at a sale to buy these native plants that were grown here. And they all died. So we got no return on it.
Yeah.
And that is heartbreaking. Number one, I really love the coneflowers. They're crazy looking. And I think that they're beautiful. And number two, I kind of wanted to dry the parts of the plant that are good for the upper respiratory ailments so I would have it in my pantry. But I do not have that right now.
Yeah. Well, one thing they say about native plants is in year one, they sleep, in year two, they creep, and in year three, they leap. So if you can get them to survive until year three, that's normally when they'll really explode. They can be slow starting out. You're right.
Yeah, and when there's no rain, they really they're not gonna do anything. It's been awful here the last two summers. I mean, I'm really happy that we moved to a place where we have more room to grow things. It would just be nice if the weather cooperated in encouraging that growth. That would be really mm-hmm. helpful. So, tell me about South Carolina, because Minnesota is not South Carolina, obviously. And are you inland? Are you near the ocean? I don't know anything about it.
South Carolina and in the upper northwest portion is kind of shaped like the beak of a bird, and it's called the Upstate. Mm-hmm. And the very northern parts of the Upstate attach to the Appalachian Mountains, so they rise from the foothills into the mountains, and they're very much like southwestern North Carolina. It's very beautiful, for one thing. Where we live, the East Otoe Valley, it's a true valley surrounded by mountains, and it's just, you know, breathtaking. And we sit on our back deck and can sit there for hours and, you know, not be the slightest bit bored. And it's just probably, in terms of just appearance, the most beautiful part of the state. When you go further inland, it's a much, you know, flatter kind of state, until you get to the coast, and then that's more of a, you know, resort area. Mm-hmm. We have temperatures that are, for us, it's typical to snow maybe once or twice a year, and a big snow for us would be 4 or 5 inches that would last for a couple of days. But it doesn't snow very much, but it does get cold by our standards. It can get down to 15 degrees in the morning and highs of mid 30s. I'm sure you would probably laugh at that, but certainly, I grew up in Florida. It's certainly a much cooler than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not going to laugh because we just went through a week of frigid temperatures. And right now, it's terribly foggy. And it's about, I think things are melting. So it must be at least at the freezing point. It must be at least 32 degrees out. And a lot of low visibility warnings on the news this morning because everybody's in this fog bank for right now.
Yeah.
But I'm real thankful that it warmed up because this past week has been awful. It's been painful to step outside. And as my family likes to joke, we suffer through the winters here to enjoy the spring, summer, and fall.
Right.
Because it is. It's suffering. No joke. It is not fun.
It can get pretty hot here in the summer, but only for about maybe 6 weeks. It'll get up sometimes to 100 degrees, but it doesn't last as long. In Florida, it can start getting hot in March and last all the way through November. So that's a real killer.
Yeah, my daughter just moved with her husband to Florida from California. And she didn't really want to go to Florida. She would have been happy staying in California. And I warned her, I said, you do understand that it's a whole different hot in Florida in the summer than California in the summer. She says, yeah. She said, I don't know how this is going to go. I said, you're going to sweat a lot, honey. And she's like, yeah, I know. I said, uh-huh. So it'll be interesting to see her take this July in Florida. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how it's going to go. So are you into any like food gardening? Do you guys do any tomatoes or cucumbers or anything?
We don't do it. And the main reason is black bears. If any kind of garden that you have about a 10-foot electric fence, you're going to attract bears. And the black bears around here are actually, you know, knock on wood, timid and not very dangerous, but you still don't want bears running around your property if you can help it. We had made a trail that runs all through our 15 acres. It's about a 45-minute trail. And again, I don't want to run into black bears there if I can help it. But we do, just only about a mile from our house is a local farm, and we're friends with the farmers there. And so we get all of our produce from there. So we do eat locally grown produce. We just don't grow it ourselves.
Okay. Farmers are good friends to have.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's delicious. I love fresh vegetables, and when they're locally grown, they're just so delicious.
Mm-hmm. So, are you going to share on your Facebook page about what you guys are doing this year with the native plants? Because I would love to keep track of that.
Yeah, we've done that somewhat. It's at the stage where if you looked at it right now, you wouldn't hardly even see anything because, again, they're in the sleep stage.
Uh-huh.
Probably by the spring, it'll be pretty apparent. And by next spring, it's going to be gorgeous. And there'll be bees, native bees flying all over the place, and butterflies and birds. And it's going to be quite something. And in fact, it's going to be very unusual for this entire area. There are even plans to have media come out and, look at it, because if it does become a seed repository, it saves these guys from having to hike 3 or 4 miles up into a mountain and find one little plant hidden behind a tree is right there for them. And so they can begin to propagate these very valuable plants, many of which have been destroyed just by, as we all know, development.
Uh-huh. Yeah. When we decided to move, it was partly because the area around us was getting built up, and we didn't think we'd see that area get built up in our lifetime. Because it was a good half an hour, 45 minutes from Twin Cities, and it was all farm fields. And we didn't think that it would get that built up. And all of a sudden, things were being built. And I was like, I really don't want to be in this.
Yeah.
And my husband was like, I really don't want to be in this either. I said, can we move further out? And he's like, how further? I said, I don't know, but further than this. And so we ended up moving another 20 minutes southwest of where we were living, which put us an hour outside of Minneapolis. But yeah, it's so hard to watch your favorite places and your landmarks go away.
Yeah. One of the reasons we bought this property is it's almost entirely surrounded by DNR land, which means it can never be developed.
Yeah.
So we're pretty much safe in that regard. There's one house we could see about a mile away, and that's about as close as anybody is to us. The only negative to being surrounded by DNR land is that people can hunt on it. So uh-huh. There are certain times of year where you hear a lot of gunshots and things, but otherwise it's almost paradise for us.
Yeah, you got to wear that orange or you're going to get shot.
Yeah.
My parents live in an area where there's, I don't know if it's DNR land, but it's all different farms, and some of the farms allow people to hunt and some don't.
Yes.
And so when they let their border collie out in, I think it's the very end of October through the end of November, they put a blaze orange bandana on her collar, and she's 8 now. And she has learned that when Dad brings out the orange collar, that's a good thing. And I guess she loses her mind. She like goes in circles and barks and dances, because she's like, I get to be pretty again. Yay.
That's funny.
And it's very cute. I don't know how dogs know these things, but they do. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah, they definitely do.
And yeah, and I had a question back 5 minutes ago, and you started talking about the stuff you're doing, and I lost the question, but I definitely want to keep up with what you guys are doing, because I think it's amazing. Oh, I know what the question was now. So with the seed repository, are you going to be providing that to people for free, or are you selling seeds, or how's that going to work?
It'll all be free from our end. We've given the landscapers permission to come on our property whenever they like to collect the seeds. It could eventually become economic for them, but early on it's very holistic on their part. They care so much about these plants, and they know so much about them, and they know how valuable they are. So it's a holistic project that maybe a few years down the road could also become financial, because again, these seeds are so difficult to come by. Certainly there'd be a lot of people willing to pay for them.
Yeah. Did you guys intend to do this? Were you approached about it, or how did it happen?
Yeah, we always intended to do it for sure. In fact, we even did it. We lived in the suburbs in Clemson before we moved here, and we even planted a lot of native plants there. Our neighbors all thought we were nuts because they all plant little ornamentals and things. But yeah, we always intended, but we didn't know the specifics of how we would do it. But then we became friends luckily with the experts in the area, and they saw us as being, you know, this is a rare opportunity for them as well to have people who are so willing and eager to do this and allowing them to use our property. Of course, we're paying them as you would landscapers. But another thing about native plants that you mentioned, that they're not for everybody in the regard that they're just not big, pretty flowers like you get from a florist or something. You know, they can have different looks and appearances that might look pretty to me, but not to someone else. So they're not for everybody, but in terms of, if you care about the environment, they are for everybody.
Yeah. Bee balm is a thing that grows here. Native, it's a native plant, and the blooms look sort of like an alien bloom. They're very spiky. Mm-hmm. And the first time I saw it, I was like, what is that? And it was years ago. My husband didn't have a clue what it was, so I had to go find somebody who knew what it was. And come to find out, bee balm leaves can be dried and used as a substitute for thyme, you know, the herb thyme.
Yeah.
And I didn't need a substitute, but I was like, okay, I want to try this and see if it actually works, because if it does, I'll grow bee balm in my yard. Because it's very different looking. And the plant that we dug out and put in came up lavender purple the first year. And the second year, it bloomed white. And
Wow. And
we didn't know that they would change colors. And then there's also a cross between burgundy and coral. So it's not really orange and it's not really purple. It's right in between. It's a very odd color. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that yet, but I'm working on it. I'm going to get it. But I did dry the leaves, and I did use it in a roast chicken, and it was very close to how thyme seasons things.
That's excellent.
So, yeah, native plants are not necessarily cutting flowers for vases. When I was growing up in Maine, they had lady slippers that grew wild. Mm-hmm. And they're absolutely native to Maine. They're native to Minnesota, too. And they are an orchid. And they look like, God, I don't know how to explain it. They're very pretty. They're pink or yellow. Mm-hmm. And they look tropical. Which is funny to me because there's nothing tropical about Maine or Minnesota. And they do. They look like a tropical plant. And I don't know anything special about lady slippers. I know that you're not allowed to cut them in the wild. Like if you get caught cutting lady slippers, you will be fined steeply. You will lose your money.
Yeah.
But you can grow them, but there are certain parameters that have to be met for the plant to actually grow. And it's something about the kind of dirt, the shade, the light, the water. It has to be exactly right for these plants to grow. And I'm sure that your native plants are the same way. You have to have right conditions.
Yeah. Yeah, there's certain ones that only grow in shade and certain ones that only grow in bright sun. But, however, native plants normally are more vigorous than ornamentals and that they can survive drought better once they're fully established and survive different conditions better, because that's where they grew up. They grew up in the same place as my backyard. They grew up 100 yards from my backyard or a mile from my backyard.
Uh-huh. Grow where you planted. I keep saying that.
Yes.
All right. So that is all awesome. And I had no idea you guys were doing that. So that's great. I'm really excited to see how that goes for you. Now, I want to talk about your writing, because that's actually how I found you years ago. I am reading your Do You Believe in Magic? Mm-hmm. The first one. There's three?
Yes, there's three. The third one won't be out until late March, but the two are out so far.
Okay, well, I'm almost done with the first one. And it reminds me a lot of the Narnia trope, the walking, mm-hmm. walking into or through some kind of door, doesn't mm-hmm. matter what kind of door it is, and you're in a different place. And it's really fun. I haven't read a young adult book in a long time, and I've been reading it before I go to bed, and I'm like, this is really fun.
Well, thank you.
Like your Death Wizard Chronicle series, it didn't get into as much because it's not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is really fun. I wish my kids were still little because I'd be reading it to them.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how it turned out. The Death Wizard Chronicles were a mature epic fantasy series, a 6-book epic fantasy series, and sort of in the mode of Game of Thrones. And I have 5 daughters, all who like to read, but they couldn't read the series because they just couldn't even believe that their dad could actually write something like that. It like freaked them out, you know how kids are about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, write something we can read, you know. So I thought, all right, I'll give it a try. And I wrote a portion of book one 3 or 4 years ago, just maybe about a third of it. And then got involved in other things. And this past February, I decided, well, you know, I'm going to, you know, go back to it. And so I started working on it this past February and published book one in May, and then wrote book two and published it in October. And now I'm almost 100,000 words into book three of the first draft of book three.
Wow.
That I'm aiming for late March, early April. But it all came about because my daughters wanted to read it. And sure enough, they've read it and really enjoyed it. And I've had, you know, even I say it's for 13 and older because it's kind of scary in the way that like the later Harry Potter books were scary.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had readers as young as 9 read it with their parents' permission and really enjoy it. And I've had people in their 80s read it and enjoy it. So adults enjoyed Harry Potter too. So it's that kind of a series as well.
Yeah, I loved Harry Potter until book 4. And then I was like, she's writing to make money now. This is not the same. And then I got through, I think there were 7 books. I got through the first 6. And the last 2 of the 6 was like pulling teeth. I was like, am I ever going to finish this book?
Yeah.
I could not give up on it. Got to 7. Read the first 2 chapters and I was like, I can't do this. And I skipped to the last chapter, read it, and I was like, yeah, no, I'm not reading the whole book. And all of my friends, including my husband, who loves Harry Potter books, were like, have you read the 7th book? And I was like, well, define read. And they're like, did you read it cover to cover? I'm like, I absolutely did not. And they're like, why? And I said, because I can't. And I love to read. Anyone who knows me knows that I love to read. And they were like, so what'd you do? I said, I read the first chapter and the second chapter and then skipped to the last chapter and read that. And I sort of kind of know where she was going.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, sacrilege, you can't do that. You have to read the last book. And I was like, nope, no, I do not. So I got lost. You know, it just wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And so I think that sometimes we feel like with books, we have to start with book one and end with the very last word of whatever the last book is in that series. And you don't have to. If you're really not enjoying it, you don't have to do it that way.
Right. Yeah. And but, this is just going to be a trilogy. And these books are, you know, in the 90,000 to 100,000 word length, as opposed to the later Harry Potter books were probably 200,000 words each.
Yeah. They got real big real quick.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that J.K. Rowling is crying herself all the way to the bank because little me didn't finish the last book or didn't read the last book. I'm sure she's terribly upset about that. But either way, I have always been impressed with you because you started off as a journalist, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then you got out of that and you started writing books. And then you also, were you a teacher at one point?
No, I ended up going into public information. I was a public information director at Clemson for about 6 years.
Okay.
That was the last job I had before I had retired, which I retired just about a year and a half ago. But I started out, I mean, to make a very long story very short, when I was in high school, I became determined that I was going to be a best-selling novelist. That's when Stephen King was just coming out and Tolkien was really becoming popular.
Yeah.
And I was convinced I was going to be a best-selling novelist and make tens of millions of dollars, and that was that. But I knew I had to, you know, support myself for the first couple of years until the books started rolling in, the money started rolling in. So I went to, when I went to college, I went, got a degree in journalism. And I happened to live in St. Petersburg, Florida, which was home then of the St. Petersburg Times, which has now been renamed the Tampa Bay Times. Mm. But back then, the St. Petersburg Times was the largest newspaper in Florida. It had a newsroom of more than 700 people. I think today's newsroom is under 100. Mm. And it was a big newspaper, and I started, you know, working, and I got married, and I started having kids. When I first started about age 20, I wrote my first book, and I shopped it around, got some bites, but it didn't publish. And I wasn't concerned, because you hear all the time, it's never your first book, it's your second or third book that really hits it. So I figured, okay, my second or third book will hit it. Mm-hmm. And I got married, started having kids, mowed the yard, blah, blah, blah. 25 years later, there was no second book.
Yeah.
Just life got in the way. But at that point, my wife and I decided to move up to upstate South Carolina. Her parents were here. They were elderly. They needed some help. And we made a killing on this house that we had in Florida on the golf course. And we made so much money on it, it enabled me to take a couple of years off and sort of step out of the rat race, because I was kind of tired.
Yeah.
And so when we moved up here, I didn't work for a couple of years. And that's when I wrote the Death Wizard Chronicles, 6 books. And I published it with a mid-sized publisher, and it did pretty well. Certainly didn't make me tens of millions of dollars, but it did pretty well. After that, I went back into journalism and continued to work. But it's funny how it is with most people, and certainly with me, when I'm working 50 hours a week, I come home, I don't have a whole lot of energy to then spend 3 hours working on a novel. So my novel writing slowed down again, but always with the thought that once I finally retired, I would pick it up again. So then I worked at Clemson in public information. That was actually a great job. I enjoyed probably my favorite job I've ever worked. But then I finally did retire. We moved into this house. I said, okay, Jim, now you got to live up to your promise and start writing novels again. And that's when, back this past February, I started on to rework book one of this series.
Uh-huh. I'm glad you did, because it's been such a joy to read something that's smart, but easily read. Like, I'm mm-hmm. not struggling through it trying to figure out where you're going. It's mm-hmm. not obvious, but it's also not difficult. And that's great for a young adult, and great for me, who's 54 and still a kid in my head. So, but anyone who thinks that writing anything that someone's going to read is easy, it's not. It is not easy to put down what you're thinking in your head on paper or into the computer. It's the reason I started doing the podcast is because I just was having a hard time with writing query letters to publications. Mm-hmm. And a lot of publications have gone out of business. The mm-hmm. the stuff that I would want to write for does not exist anymore.
Right.
And there are so many people who are still dying to write for anyone, that there's such a huge pool of people who are willing to write for free that it becomes almost, I don't know, discouraging to even sit down to write a query letter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a long wait time. You know this. If you send out a query, you could wait 6 months and then get a yes or never hear anything. And so I was like, I need to cut out the middleman. I need to have something that I'm doing. And the only person it relies on other than me is the person I'm interviewing. Mm-hmm. And And I have been able to find out so many things about so many people and share it with people who want to learn from those people just by sitting at a desk in my room in front of my laptop. And it's been so fun. And I was telling another person that I interviewed the other day that I am so excited and so high after I get done talking with people on these podcasts because I learn so much and people genuinely love what they're doing and that comes through. And that makes me happy. So I come down the stairs and my husband's like, "Are you high?" And I'm like, "Yep, sure am." I say, can I tell you what I learned? And he's like, "Yep, lay it on me." And he's learned that if he doesn't just say, "Yep," I'm going to be dropping pieces of what I learned the rest of the day to him. So like, I don't want to discourage anyone from trying to get published because there's also nothing like getting a yes and then seeing it in the publication that you sent what you wrote to. But it's hard and you have to be patient and you have to understand that there will be no's before there are yeses to what you wrote.
Yeah. And interesting what you're saying. Congratulations, by the way. And I think it's fabulous that you're doing this and also enjoying it and spreading the word to so many other people. I think that's great. As a journalist, whenever I would go out on an interview, and sometimes the interviews could be quite painful. Uh-huh. You know, you're talking to people that have had terrible things happen to them. You'd always have just this very mild anxiety as you headed toward the interview. Mm-hmm. But once you were in the interview, it was almost always rewarding for me as a reporter. I know exactly what you're saying. You walk away from it and you just see this fresh perspective and you just realize that so many people are intelligent and have so many things to say. And here they are saying it to you. And it's a very rewarding experience.
It really is. It's almost like reverse therapy. Yeah. I'm not sharing my problems with somebody. They're sharing their ideas with me and I get to just absorb those and learn from them. So it may not even be reverse therapy. It just may be therapy. I don't know, but at least it's not costing me $400 an hour.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because my wife's a psychotherapist. So she was actually a journalist most of her life and then reinvented herself and became a psychotherapist. So that's what she does for a living.
Yeah. And it's really good work. If you can get it and if you're good at it, it's fantastic.
Yes.
I think that I would have trouble walking into any therapist's office and sitting down and being like, "So what's going on?" And I would blank. I would be like, I don't know. What are you asking me? But it's also really fun doing this because I hop on my computer and I put my headphones in and I say, "Hi, whoever you are, tell me about your place and what you do." And it gives people a chance to just geek out about what they're doing and what they love about it. And I feel like when you are passionate about something, people want to know, but they don't want to invest a lot of time in listening to you geek out about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this gives people a chance to talk for at least 10 minutes at the beginning of the interview about what they do, why they do it, how they do it, what they love about it. And then I jump in and say, "Okay, so now I have questions," because invariably they haven't actually hit on a specific thing. It's a big, happy download overview of what they do. Mm-hmm. And so then I'm like, "Okay, so you mentioned this. What does that do? What does that mean?" And it's such a great format or platform for people to be able to share. And I really wanted to do that. And I really wanted something that I could do where I'm at home. And if my dog needs to go out, I can schedule my interviews around the dog, you know?
Yes.
So
if you don't mind, if I could riff off something you said, because you, when you talked about how doing this podcast has given you control, you don't have to wait 6 months for somebody to give you approval to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the very reason why I chose to self-publish this series versus go traditionally, because I didn't want to wait 6 months. I didn't want to have to go through all the querying for agents and publishers. And it can be 6 months to a year, and it can be 6 months to a year and you hear nothing.
Yeah.
And the industry is, in that regard, has only gotten worse. And it's really reached the point where unless you get into one of the really major, like top 10 publishers, if you're looking at it just from purely a financial standpoint, you can make more money self-publishing than you can with a mid-sized or a small publisher for the most part, because you control everything. You control the marketing. You make all the decisions.
Yeah.
And so especially even more so with genre series like epic fantasy or mystery or romance, and multiple book series are very popular among self-published people. And there are hundreds and hundreds of millions of people now who read ebooks, and they don't care if they're self-published or Simon & Schuster. They will read them and buy them. So the audience is huge and the potential for success is huge. So that's why I decided to go with self-publishing. It's no longer a stigma. And anyone out there who's thinking about writing a novel but saying, well, I'll never be able to find a publisher. Hey, you can be the publisher.
Yeah, and Amazon and I don't know, I'm trying to think of the other one. Amazon has made it really easy to be your own publisher.
Mm-hmm.
If you can read and follow directions, you can publish your book.
Yes, exactly.
Barnes and Noble.
Barnes and Noble.
It was Nook, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Same thing. I don't know if they're still doing it because I haven't looked at Barnes and Noble in forever, but there are so many ways and formats and platforms to publish whatever it is you want to put out there that anybody can do it. Now, having said that, I think that you should definitely have someone who is good at editing proof your writing and help you make it pretty and readable, because there's a lot of stuff out there that is not great. But
yes,
if you're really determined to get your idea out there, absolutely. I think that self-publishing is the way to go. I have not been in a library or a physical bookstore in over 4 years because mm-hmm. I get all my books online. I read them on my tablet.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss bookstores. I really do. I used to consider that my church. Any bookstore I walked into, it was like church for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss that. But the last time I was in a bookstore, I didn't get that feeling again.
Right.
So much for my church.
Well, you hear so many people say, I have to read a book. I have to hold it in my hands. I can't read online. And there's a lot to be said for that. But I think what a lot of people find is I'm going to go ahead and read this ebook. And after a while, you start getting used to that format and you end up enjoying the ebooks pretty much as you do as paperback or hardcovers, I believe.
Yeah. I don't know that it matters how the words get into your eyeballs, into your brain, as long as they do.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I agree with you completely. If anyone has a book idea, or I mean, even if you had a magazine idea, there are magazine templates. I don't think that's the right word. Themes in WordPress that you could actually start your own magazine online.
Yeah,
if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I don't quite understand is there was such a stigma about self-publishing not even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. If you self-published, you weren't legitimate, blah, blah, blah. And I never understood that, because why is it any different for you to sit down at your computer and use whatever word processing program you use, Word, and those words are not any different whether a publishing company takes those words and formats into a book or whether you do it. They're
right.
The same words. It used to frustrate me.
Yeah. The one thing that the major publishing houses have is, well, there's two things. One is they tend to pay pretty generous advances. Mm-hmm. And the other is they get them into bookstores and libraries. And nowadays, mid-sized and small publishers just don't do that at all. And it's really become a very ebook focused world, especially in terms of growth, although that even that's starting to change a little bit. The publishing industry changes so much.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the key to self-publishing, or the good news for a self-publisher, is there are literally hundreds and hundreds of millions of people around the world who read ebooks. And so if you get 0.1% of that, you're a bestseller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, the reason that I approached you about talking with you on my podcast is because I feel like writing absolutely is a craft. And I say in my intro that it's conversations with homesteaders, cottage food producers, and crafters. And I don't want people to think that crafter necessarily means making a solid, you can hold it object all the time, because mm-hmm. writing is absolutely a craft. People who are born with a talent for writing are the most blessed people on earth. And if you can actually take that and use it and create a story that someone reads and walks away feeling better or learning something, I think that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Well, whatever your craft might be, it's a learning process, and mm-hmm. you're going to be better at your craft 10 years down the road than you are the first day you started. Writing is the same thing. Writing, to become a writer in terms of writing as a craft, starts when you're in elementary school and you begin to learn about punctuation and grammar, and you begin to build your vocabulary. And then it continues to grow as you read books and you read. Uh-huh. And then the first story you write isn't going to be as good as the 1,000th story you write. I've written probably 10 million words over the course of my lifetime as a professional writer. And you just continue to get better. I guess to the point where you finally get so old, you can't think clearly anymore. But in that regard, it is a craft, and it's a craft in the sense that you have to learn techniques. You have to have a vocabulary. You have to have a voice. You have to, you know, punctuation and grammar are very important. And so in that regard, there are tools that are necessary. And then from there, if you have those tools, especially highly refined, your imagination takes over and creates art.
Yeah. I just finished reading Stephen King's the book Holly.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't read anything by him in a while. Like, I've kept up, but I just hadn't read a book by Stephen King in a while. And what I really found, because I read Salem's Lot back when I was 14, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of his first. And it was very, as I recall, it was very choppy. And it was very shock value, and that okay. was fine. I'm all good with that. But the big difference between then and this new book, Holly, it's much more subtle. And when the shock value moments happen, it's not like it's gratuitous. It's very much part of the story. And it was a joy to see how much he's changed and how much he hasn't changed in the same breath.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happens. I think that any art form or craft or skill that you practice and practice and practice, you become less clunky and more subtle in the end result.
Right. That's right.
And I'm seeing it in your book too. A lot of what I'm seeing in this new one, or the first one in the new series, it's very easy. It's very smooth. And mm-hmm. and even with Dreamhouse, it was not this subtle or smooth. And
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to insult you, because I love you. I think you're fantastic. But there are big differences between the beginning thing and the later on thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're paying attention, you'll see it.
Yeah, and for this book, I did exactly what you're saying. I did it on purpose. the first draft of book one was about 120,000 words, and it ended up at about 90,000. So over the course of 10 revisions, I reduced the length by 30,000 words, which is not insignificant. But what it does is it sort of gets rid of all the fat and everything and turns it into a very lean machine, so to speak. And that's what you're sensing. The same regard, I think readers have also changed in that direction. I don't know if it's all the internet, but the internet has certainly played a large role in that, where the people just don't concentrate as much as they used to, and they don't want to pick up Ulysses or a book like that. I those books are more about the prose than they are about the story. Uh-huh. And as a writer, I can really enjoy magnificent prose. Same regard, most readers nowadays, I think they really are interested in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I used to love about Stephen King's writing, I'm going to stay with him, is that the way that he would say things, the art of the sentence that he built, mm-hmm. was the thing I love most about how he wrote. And that's not as there now as it used to be. And I don't know if it's because he's writing differently or because I'm reading differently. Mm-hmm. But I know when I was in my 20s, I would read his new books and I would write down in a journal sentences that I loved how he constructed the sentence. And I had a book, I had a journal full of just the name of the book, the author, the sentence, what I loved about it, how mm-hmm. the sentence was built. I was obsessed with this. And I don't have that journal anymore. But it's really interesting how people craft or build the words that make the story. And mm-hmm. I'm a geek. I love words. I love reading. I used to love writing, not so much now. I like talking. Talking mm-hmm. is easier. But but there's such a magic to writing and having it turn out to be what you wanted it to be.
Yeah, Stephen King, you know, you talk about if you're born with the ability to write, that's really valuable. There's one more level above that, and that's you're a genius. Uh-huh. And Stephen King is a genius, and there are a very small percentage of writers across the past 150 years who you would qualify as geniuses. And a genius can pretty much do anything they want to do because they're a genius. Mm-hmm. But Stephen King had a two-part career, as I'm sure you know. His first part, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he
would
drink himself half to sleep and still write brilliantly. Mm-hmm. And then he became sober and continued to write. And there was definitely a difference in his writing. I think his writing became clearer and simpler and shorter than it was before he became sober. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I prefer one or the other, to be honest, but that's his story.
Yeah, I don't know. I still love his stuff. There's been a couple that I read and went, eh. But most of his books and his short stories, I really do enjoy. Mm-hmm. But again, he's terribly clever and very talented. And there's something magical about the way he puts things together. And magic is a big deal. You know, life is so fast and immediate now that I don't feel like people have the time to recognize magic in anything. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Maine in the woods, and there was everything magical about that. And when we moved here to this 3-acre place that we're on now, mm-hmm. I finally had a chance to breathe and look around and go, oh, this place has magic. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean magic like witches' cauldrons and I have Newt and Frog right. and whatever. I mean magic where you see something and your breath is taken away and you just stop. Yeah. There's just that moment of stepping out of time and experiencing the thing and then stepping back into time. And I think that for me, that's what books have always been. And so I'm very tickled that the name of your newest series is Do You Believe in Magic? Because yes, I do. So anyway, Jim, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me. And I know we've been all over the place, but I wanted to know what you were doing. And I wanted to talk to you about your new series and about words and just geek out for a minute on stuff I love. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. And good luck in your future with doing this.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you again like a year and a half from now and see how your seed repository is doing.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
All right. Awesome. You have a great day.
Have a great day. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.